Radio Buddhist Youth Association. Good afternoon, everyone. You are listening to the sound of universal compassion. Please enjoy.
This show is brought to you by the Buddhist Youth Association every Sunday, bringing Buddhism to the community of the Waikato. We also give away a range of free English or Chinese Buddhism books, MP3 or tapes on Buddhism. If you'd like one, please send a letter with $3 worth of stamps in an envelope to P.O. Box 82146, Highland Park, Howick, Auckland. Or you can phone 09271-3377. Buddhist Youth Association. Respectful, beneficial, empowering. Hello and welcome back to our examination of the text, Mind Training Like the Rays of the Sun, by the Tibetan master of ancient times, Namkapel. Although we've been going through this text for a few weeks now, we've only just completed the preliminary practices, those practices that will help turn our mind away from ordinary concerns and towards the study and understanding of the Dharma. These preliminaries are actually the first of the 7 points of mind training covered by Namkapel's text, and the second is how to develop actual bodhicitta. Now, if you've been with the program for a long time, you will probably have an understanding of what bodhicitta is, since we've gone through it quite extensively in other texts. However, if you're new to the program, and especially Mahayana Buddhism, you may not know what is meant by this term, bodhicitta. Even long-time students sometimes get confused and think that bodhicitta means developing lots of compassion for other beings. But bodhicitta is much more than that. If you really want an exhaustive explanation of the term, you can delve into Francis Bressard's volume, The Concept of Bodhicitta in Shantideva's Bodhicharya Vatara. But in very simple terms, bodhi means awakening or enlightened essence, and citta is mind or heart. So bodhicitta means the awakening mind or the heart of the enlightened mind. In the Snow Lion publication, The Path to Bliss, a book of teachings by His Holiness the Dalai Lama, edited by Thupten Jinpa, the Dalai Lama explains that the etymological meaning of the Tibetan term for bodhicitta, semkhe, is to enhance one's courage or mental attitude. Therefore, His Holiness says, bodhicitta is an altruistic state of mind that aspires to attain the completely enlightened state for the benefit of all other sentient beings. And this follows the definition in an ancient text studied by the Gelugpas, Maitreya's Abhisamayalankara, or Filigree of Realizations, where the definition reads, arousing bodhicitta is, for the sake of others, longing to attain complete enlightenment. And with that in mind, it seems a good time to take a moment to focus on our motivation for participating in the program today. What is your motivation? If it's anything less than bodhicitta, try seeing that all sentient beings, that basically means beings with consciousness, but deluded consciousness, not pure like the Buddha's, are in a state of suffering, although wanting happiness, just like oneself. As His Holiness says, you should think, I can help them fully only when I myself have achieved the completely enlightened state, the noble state that the objects of refuge have all realized, for the benefit of all sentient beings. With this kind of thought, then, we'll take a moment to generate our motivation for participating in the program today. Thank you. The name of the chapter we are embarking on in Namkapel's text is Cultivating the Conventional Awakening Mind. And it goes on to explain what is meant by the conventional awakening mind and the ultimate awakening mind. The text reads, there are two approaches to the basic practice of developing the precious awakening mind, that dealing with the process of training in the conventional awakening mind and that involved in the process of cultivating the ultimate awakening mind. The former includes an explanation of how we are able to enter the great vehicle only by activating the altruistic mind of enlightenment, and is followed by a description of the actual techniques for cultivating the precious awakening mind. The latter, dealing with the development of the view of emptiness, will be dealt with later. The text then goes on under the subheading, Appreciating the Value of the Awakening Mind, the Entrance to the Great Vehicle. Since it is necessary to embark upon the Great Vehicle, as pointed out above, you may wonder what is the entrance to such activity. Now, before we continue with this, a word of explanation about the Tibetan explanation of the vehicles of Buddhism. According to the Tibetan system, there are three vehicles, the Hinayana, the Mahayana, and the Vajrayana. Now, as you've probably gathered, yana means vehicle. Hinayana means the lower vehicle. Mahayana means the great vehicle, and Vajrayana indicates the tantric vehicle. Actually, the word Hinayana does not only mean lower, but as we will see, has a pejorative sense, as in inferior, and even poor or miserable. Now, the vehicles are called such because they can be used to transport practitioners across the sea of samsara to liberation. Now, of course, no practitioner call themselves Hinayana, although the name is often associated with the Theravadan tradition today. And as we will see, nobody has ever claimed to be a Hinayana practitioner. It seems it is something that those who call themselves Mahayana practitioners have constructed. And I personally find these divisions uncomfortable and unnecessary. It seems to me they easily foster a sense of superiority that could allow unnecessary disharmony among the Buddha's followers. In line with this, Chris Ward of the Amaravit Lay Buddhist Association, which runs a Theravadan monastery in Herefordshire, Britain, has written an appealing article called The Inferior Path, The Mysterious Hinayana, though he sees some value in discriminating among the teachings. His article on www.clear-vision.org goes like this. It's not long before the Buddhist practitioner encounters the idea of the Hinayana. Now, usually the word is to be found in a Mahayana context, and quite often the term is used as though it is based on widely accepted Buddhist teachings. However, the truth is that there's no such thing as Hinayana in the sense of a substantive Buddhist school, tradition, or sect, or as a distinct early doctrine, or as any current Buddhist tradition. In these contexts, Hinayana is a mythical beast, which started life as a term of abuse, then expanded to take on a life of its own as the bogeyman of the Mahayana, and ended up in Tibetan doctrine as one of the number of yanas, vehicles or paths of practice. He quotes various scholars of the history to back up his views, from Paul Williams in his book Buddhist Thought to Jay Strong in The Experience of Buddhism, and Paul Harrison in the article Who Gets to Ride in the Great Vehicle? Self-Image and Identity Among the Followers of the Early Mahayana in the Journal of the International Association of Buddhist Studies, Volume 10, Number 1. Ward then goes on, so what exactly does the word Hinayana mean? Although sometimes described as small or lesser vehicle, Hina is defined in the Pali English Dictionary as inferior, low, poor, miserable, vile, base, contemptible, despicable, and has similar meanings in Sanskrit. So at best, Hinayana means the inferior vehicle or path, and at worst, the vile, contemptible, or despicable vehicle. The term was clearly intended to be polemical and abusive, and he references Paul Williams' book on page 96. The Hinayana word first appeared in a few Mahayana sutras and gradually hardened in tone over time. Sutras, like all early texts, were written by monks and nuns. However, unlike the Pali canon, which is regarded as recording the words of the historic Buddha and his immediate disciples, sutras generally represent the insights of the later authors. Having said this, it's hardly surprising that over a period of several hundred years following the Buddha's demise, some monks and nuns developed profound insights and felt moved to communicate these. Mahayana sutras may take earlier teachings and present them in a new light, or take them to a logical conclusion, or they may change the emphasis of the earlier teachings. And here he references Paul Williams again, but in an earlier book titled Mahayana Buddhism, on pages 28 to 30. He goes on, sutras often emphasize the importance of compassion and skillful means and the motivation to follow the Bodhisattva path to full Buddhahood. So who were the early objects of the Hinayana description? Apart from those who disagreed with the sutra containing the condemnation, it's not clear. No body or group has ever claimed to be Hinayana. Neither is there any evidence of conflict to explain the defensiveness in the sutras. Those monks and nuns who had Mahayanist tendencies lived amicably with monks and nuns who did not. And again he references Paul Williams in Buddhist Thought on page 97. And the insults are not returned. There appears to be no Mahayana writer who felt moved to respond to the charge of being one of the Hinayana, so presumably there was no one who felt that the description applied to them. If there had been a lively debate between actual Buddhist schools, we might have expected some mention in commentaries such as Nagarjuna's works or in Buddhaghosa's Path of Purification, a work now regarded as a compendium of Theravada doctrine. This is especially so when we consider that Mahayana sutras, which used the Hinayana word, were being written from about 100 BCE onwards, and Buddhaghosa was active around 500 CE. He could be expected to have been well aware of any such controversy if one had actually existed. We might assume then that the abuse was aimed at hypothetical recipients, in the same way that an old-fashioned schoolteacher might have said that he does not want any silly slackers in his class. The point is that no one would claim to be from the class of silly slackers, just as no tradition has ever called itself Hinayana. Nevertheless, in what looks like a compounding of errors, a 2,000-year-old term of abuse describing hypothetical Buddhist silly slackers was then given fresh substance within the Tibetan tradition. Gradually, leading up to around 1,000 to 1,200 CE, the idea of the three vehicles arose. These are described as the Hinayana, the Mahayana, and the Vajrayana. This places the mythical Hinayana as a basic practice and links it with the idea of the Arahant, the perfected human in the Pali canon and in current Theravada practice. The Bodhisattva path is emphasized within Mahayana, and Vajrayana is presented as the fast path to Buddhahood. This Tibetan hierarchy appears to be partly based upon a mistranslation of Hinayana into the Tibetan Tegpa Mempa, which actually means a poor or limited spiritual motivation. It's a pity that the Hinayana word has become conflated with spiritual aspiration in Tibetan teachings, since there is a useful distinction to be made between the levels of altruism or selfishness that practitioners of any contemporary Buddhist persuasion, whether Theravada or Mahayana, may adopt. And he references Williams' Buddhist Thought, pages 101 to 102. He goes on, "Unfortunately, the Hinayana confusion has been given a further twist as Buddhism has established itself within the West. The term is often taken at face value and inappropriately used in books and websites." Chris Ward then uses an uncredited quote which says that Hinayana, meaning lesser vehicle, should not be seen as a reproach or a belittling of the first vehicle teachings, for without such teachings, and I quote, "which are particularly appropriate for those who have limited wisdom or diligence, many would not have been able to practice the Mahayana." The quote goes on to say that the fundamental teachings of the Hinayana are found in the first turning of the wheel of Dharma, that is, the Four Noble Truths and so on. Chris Ward comments, "So in spite of statements that the term is not pejorative, we see Hinayana identified with the whole of the teachings of the Pali canon and intended for those who are of limited wisdom or diligence." He then finds another quote from an uncredited website pointing out the equivalence of the Theravada and Hinayana. The quote says that after the Buddha died, his teachings took two main forms as it spread into China on the Silk Route: the Theravada or Hinayana, the lesser vehicle, and the Mahayana or greater vehicle. Chris Ward claims that even though Theravada as we know it evolved from an early school or schools, it only settled into its current form around 500 CE, well after the Hinayana term first appeared. Others have also found the term Hinayana uncomfortable and Ward points out that alternative terms have been put forward over several years. He quotes an article in Religious Traditions, Volume 3, Number 1, in which the author N. Katz proposes using the term Shravakayana for non-Mahayana forms of Buddhism, as they emphasize arahatship as the highest goal, admitting, however, that even there one finds a bodhisattva path with an aspiration for Buddhahood. He also quotes some other authors who prefer the term mainstream Buddhism for non-Mahayana forms, and also mentions geographical descriptions such as southern, northern, and eastern Buddhism, and, from a historical or doctrinal point of view, descriptions like early, middle, or later Buddhism. In summary, he says, modern scholarship indicates that the term Hinayana cannot be linked with any early or modern Buddhist tradition, but was a general term of abuse used to defend the message contained in some new sutras. No ancient or modern tradition has ever regarded itself as the inferior or contemptible path, and the term has no place as a general description of Buddhist practice today. There are many alternative terms that more accurately describe early or contemporary Buddhist teachings and motivations, and which avoid confusion and possible offense. No sincere Buddhist would profess to following an inferior path, and no polite Buddhist would say this of a fellow practitioner. It has been said that perhaps the followers of the mysterious Hinayana were those who originally coined the term Hinayana. Nicely put, don't you think? Okay, so that was a bit of a digression, but it kind of puts the Tibetan emphasis on the great vehicle in its place, historically at least. In the meantime, we will have to go along with terms like greater and lesser vehicle as favored by the Tibetans as we go through the Tibetan texts. And to practice the great vehicle, you have to develop a bodhicitta motivation. And this motivation is called the entrance into the Mahayana or great vehicle. Noam Karpel writes, in stating that there are two aspects to the great vehicle, the practices of the transcending perfections and those of secret mantra, Buddha the Conqueror has made it clear that there's no great vehicle practice other than these two. Furthermore, the entrance to each of them is only by means of the awakening mind. The moment it arises in your mental continuum, even if you have not generated any other quality, you become a follower of the great vehicle. On the contrary, the moment it is lost, you fall to the level of the lower vehicle hearers and so on, even though you may possess such qualities and an understanding of emptiness. Such a falling away from the great vehicle is referred to in many great vehicle scriptures and can also be established by reasoning. So whether you are considered a practitioner of the great vehicle or not depends simply on whether you possess this attitude. In fact, the great vehicle is indicated by nothing but the presence or absence of this very state of mind. He then goes on to quote a verse from Shantideva's Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, which says, the instant the awakening mind is activated, those bound up in the prison of cyclic existence come to be known as sons of the Buddhas gone to bliss. He also quotes from the life story of the exalted Maitreya, which says, O child of my family, here are some analogies. The awakening mind is like a diamond, even a fragment of which surpasses all other kinds of valuable ornaments such as gold, which retains the name diamond and can eradicate all poverty. O child of my family, in the same way, the precious diamond-like mind, which gives rise to omniscience, even when it is weak, outshines all the golden qualities adorning the hearers and solitary realizers. Because of it, you retain the name of bodhisattva and eradicate all the poverty of cyclic existence. Do you notice the disparagement, slight though it may be, of those who follow the so-called Hinayana path? He then goes on to further quote from the Exuberance of the Array of Tree Trunk Sutra, which goes like this. O child of my family, the awakening mind is like the seed of all the teachings of the Buddhas. It is like the field in which the positive actions of all wandering beings prosper. It is like the earth on which the whole world depends. It is like the son of the Lord of Wealth, who completely eliminates all kinds of poverty. It is like the Father, completely protecting all bodhisattvas. It is like King of wish-granting jewels, which perfectly fulfills every purpose. It is like the miraculous vase which acts to accomplish every wish. It is like the spear vanquishing the foe of disturbing emotions. It's like armor guarding you from improper thoughts. It is like a sword beheading the disturbing emotions. It's like an axe felling the tree of disturbing emotions. It is like a weapon staving off all kinds of attack. It is like the hook which draws you out of the waters of cyclic existence. It's like the whirlwind which scatters all mental obscurations and their sources. It is like the condensed teaching that encompasses all the prayers and activities of the bodhisattvas. It is like the shrine before which all the gods, humans and demigods of the world can present their offerings. A child of my family, the awakening mind is endowed like this with these and immeasurable other excellent qualities. Namkapel then claims that the moment bodhicitta is born in our mind, all the obscurations of previously accumulated actions are burnt up. That's quoted from the text. And, also quoted, it acts to protect you from all miseries and fears. Now, I don't quite know what this means, because relative bodhicitta, as great as it is, does not have the power to take us to liberation, which would indicate all our karma was burnt up. Only the wisdom realizing the nature of reality, or ultimate bodhicitta, has that power. However, it is also taught that the birth of bodhicitta creates enormous positive potential in the mind. So perhaps these two sentences refer to that, or to what Namkapel writes next. It begins to provide you with the inexhaustible fruits of higher states of rebirth and the definite goodness of liberation. It is like the quintessential butter arising from the churning of the ocean of scriptures. It is like the seed that is the exclusive proximate cause leading you to the fully awakened state of being. He goes on to say that when we realize the benefits of bodhicitta, our heartstrings should resound with joy, as while this precious human rebirth gives us the opportunity to practice the Dharma, specifically practicing the awakening mind is sure to be a source of great encouragement. In his commentary on this part of the text, His Holiness the Dalai Lama says the benefits of developing a bodhicitta aim are infinite. When we reflect on the Buddha Shakyamuni and why he's such a precious and important person, he says, it's because he had developed a kind and warm heart, and based on that, he developed a bodhicitta aim to attain enlightenment for the benefit of all. When we consider the advantages of having a kind and warm heart, of being a good person, we can see them even in animals. If we have a cat that just sits around nicely and purrs, we will give it food and be very nice towards it. But if the cat is always jumping around and acting wildly, scratching and biting and the like, no one is going to be pleased with such an animal, and it may have problems getting fed. As for human beings, if we are kind and warm, everything comes our way. But if we are crude and mean, no one will want to be with us. Now, this is quite true. When we started the temple in Auckland in 1996, the cat that adopted us had a habit of letting you stroke her for a while, but then suddenly she would turn on you with all claws and teeth, and often people kind to her were left with bleeding hands or arms. She became quite well known for this kind of behavior. One day, just after a teaching, this happened to a young lady who tried to be friendly with a cat. The cat turned on her and scratched her. But the teacher, a wise old monk sitting at the head of the congregation, who didn't tolerate bad behavior all that well, grabbed one of his slippers and hurled it at the cat. It didn't hit, but the animal got such a fright, she took off like a rocket out of the room. And from that time on, she was somewhat more subdued, and later became a friendly and much more docile moggy that everyone liked much better. His Holiness continues, it's extremely important to work on developing all these positive states of mind. The love that wishes everyone happiness, the compassion that wishes everyone freedom from suffering, and the heartwarming type of love for all others. If on the basis of these we have developed a bodhicitta aim on our mental continuum, then just on the basis of that we will build up bountiful stores or networks of various types of positive force. So bodhicitta in itself will build up various potencies to protect us and rid us of hindrances. Just to say the word bodhicitta or to hear it spoken is profoundly positive and instructive. When we were discussing bodhicitta in one of the other texts, I can't now remember which one, I quoted from a teaching on bodhicitta by Lama Yeshe, the founder of the Foundation of the Preservation of the Mahayana Tradition. It was a long time ago, so you've probably forgotten it. So I'm going to dare to quote it again. Here goes. On www.lamayeshe.com, Lama Yeshe says, "I think it is absolutely essential for us to have loving kindness towards others. There's no doubt about this. Loving kindness is the essence of bodhicitta, the attitude of the bodhisattva. It is the most comfortable path, the most comfortable meditation. There can be no philosophical, scientific, or psychological disagreement with this. With bodhicitta, there's no east-west conflict. This path is the most comfortable, most perfect, 100% uncomplicated one, free of any danger of leading people to extremes. Without bodhicitta, nothing works. And most of all, your meditation doesn't work and realizations don't come. Why is bodhicitta necessary for success in meditation? Because of selfish grasping. If you have a good meditation but don't have bodhicitta, you will grasp at any little experience of bliss. Me, me, I want more, I want more. Then the good experience disappears completely. Grasping is the greatest distraction to experiencing single-pointed intensive awareness in meditation. And with it, we're always dedicated to our own happiness. Me, me, I'm miserable. I want to be happy. Therefore, I'll meditate. It doesn't work that way. For some reason, good meditation and its results, peacefulness, satisfaction, and bliss, just don't come." Now, without any disrespect to Lama Yeshe or to the awakening mind, to this, of course, the question arises, why are many Theravadan meditators then successful? Many, presumably without bodhicitta, have attained great states of realization, peace, satisfaction, and bliss. One only has to listen to the talks of Ajahn Brahm to understand this. But to returning to Lama Yeshe, he says that without bodhicitta, it's very difficult to collect merits. He says, "You create them and immediately destroy them. By afternoon, the morning's merits have gone. It's like cleaning a room and an hour later making it dirty again. You make your mind clean, then right away you mess it up. Not a very profitable business. If you want to succeed in the business of collecting merits, you must have bodhicitta. With bodhicitta, you become so precious, like gold, like diamonds. You become the most perfect object in the world, beyond compare with any material things. From the Western materialistic point of view, we'd think it was great if a rich person said, 'I want to make charity. I'm going to offer $100 to everybody in the entire world.' Even if that person gave with great sincerity, his or her merit would be nothing compared with just the thought, 'I wish to actualize bodhicitta for the sake of sentient beings, and I'll practice the six paramitas as much as I can.' That's why I always say, actualization of bodhicitta is the most perfect path you can take." He goes on, "What we have to do is transform our attachment and self-cherishing, and if we haven't changed our mind in this way, none of the other practices work. Doing them is just a joke. Even if you try to practice tantric meditations, unless you've changed within, you won't succeed. Dharma means a complete change of attitude. That's what really brings you inner happiness. That is the true Dharma, not the words you say. Bodhicitta is not the culture of ego, not the culture of attachment, not the culture of samsara. It is an unbelievable transformation, the most comfortable path, the most substantial path, definite, not wishy-washy." So, as with that, we've now run out of time. Let's do the not wishy-washy thing and dedicate our efforts today to gaining enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings. Thank you very much for joining the program, and I hope you'll tune in again next week. Have a wonderful one. Goodbye.
the sky.